Welcome to Living Orthodoxy, an invitation to a deeper life in Christ, a podcast of St. Philip Orthodox Church in Souderton, Pennsylvania, dedicated to connecting the liturgical and spiritual life of the Orthodox parish with the life of the Orthodox home, presenting the weekly homilies of our parish pastors, Father Noah Buscelli and Father James Thayer, as well as discussions of the liturgical year and Orthodox life and practice by Justin Gold and Jeff Hyatt.
On Saturday, March 17th of 2018, Deacon Mark Barna joined us at St. Philip's for our annual Lenten retreat titled A Christian Ending, a hands-on workshop for establishing burial ministry teams. Deacon Mark joined us for the full day, and we have recorded all of those sessions and are making them available on the Living Orthodoxy podcast with his permission. So we pray that these sessions are as edifying to you as they were to us who were in attendance at the retreat on March 17th. May God bless you as you listen to the retreat, A Christian Ending, with Deacon Mark Barna.
This next part is about some legal issues and elder care. Is there anyone here who is currently a caregiver? Well, pat yourself on the back. Someone pat her on the back. It's the toughest job there is. Anyone have small children? You're a caregiver. It's the same thing. It's 24/7. It can carry a whole lot more emotional baggage, and it is fraught with spiritual peril. My wife was the primary caregiver for three of our parents. Her mother died several years before of metastasized breast cancer, and that introduced us to hospice, and we became the best friends of hospice through that experience. It's just a wonderful, wonderful program we'll talk about a little bit more. But when her mother died, we realized that it wasn't going to be long before Frank would have to be with us. We lived in a two-story house at the time, and we looked around at that house and said, we can't take care of Frank here. So we started looking for a house that would be more appropriate for him, and we found a huge money pit in the hood and bought it, started remodeling it, but it was absolutely perfect for our needs. And we started remodeling that, and as expected, it wasn't long before Frank moved in with us. In the meantime, we were there for a few years before Frank moved in. We had a few years, 3 or 4 years, or what, time flies, where we were involved with I don't know if you have anything similar in Pennsylvania. In South Carolina, the Department of Mental Health has a program called Home Share, where you can help people coming out of the state mental hospital try to reintegrate and become self-supporting, self-sustaining, productive members, however you want to put it. We did that for 3 or 4 years, and that was quite an experience. But then finally, Frank needed to move in, so we put an end to that, and we took in Frank. And the next thing we knew, my parents moved in. So when we were married, I remember one of our earliest conversations as a married couple was, we looked at our siblings and said, okay, we're going to get to take care of the parents. We at that time, we were 25 years old, maybe 26, and we looked at our siblings and said, okay, it's us. So we had 20 years to prepare, and that's important. It was just our frame of reference. It was something that we knew was going to happen, and in that regard, it didn't sneak up on us. What did sneak up on us was all three of them moved in within 2 weeks of each other. Be careful what you wish for. We never expected that. My mother and her dad had Alzheimer's, and my dad had Parkinson's. And it was quite an experience. So, as I said, Elizabeth was really the primary caregiver. She was in the thick of it, and I'm really sorry that she's not here for you to hear from her. And I'll do the best that I can. First, let me say, as I said, this was a large, primarily all on one level. It was perfect for what we needed. We knew that eventually they'd be in wheelchairs. We knew that we'd need hospital beds. We knew all of this stuff. Fortunately, she was able to quit her job. She had a very good job, and she was able to quit it to be the primary caregiver. The parents had good financial resources. They had good pensions, they had good insurance, they had Social Security, they had veterans benefits and things, so they weren't able to replace her whole salary, but that's okay. It's hard to believe what she went through. She tells us that she spent a lot of time crying. She didn't tell me about it. One day, the mail lady, she thought she would grab a quick shower while things were quiet in the house, which is hard to do when you're a 24/7 caregiver. Even taking a shower becomes difficult. So she got out of the shower, and the mail lady rang the doorbell. She went to the door, and she said, there's a lady in your backyard climbing over the fence. So she went out to get my mom off the fence. We have a brick wall that goes around the property, and she was climbing the wall, literally climbing the walls. And then as she was getting her down off the wall, she looked down the street, and there was her dad about 300 yards down the street. So she got mom in the house, and she got in the car. She went down to get her dad, and she said, Frank, where are you going? He said, I'm going to Pittsburgh to see my dad. He said, well, get in the car, I'll take you. And she brought him back home. Well, my dad was very bitter, and he was not really nice about it. And he thought it would be a really neat trick to let them out while she was in the shower. And he did stuff like this. He was not easy to get along with, and he had dementia caused by his Parkinson's. And he was an alcoholic. So she had to have a come to Jesus meeting with him. She sat him down and she told him, you may not like it here, but if you don't straighten up, you and Louise are going to a nursing home. And he got with the program then. And that's when we were able to get her some help. He loosened up the purse strings a little bit, and we were able to get some health care to get some ladies. It actually took a long time. I think it took almost 2 years to find the people that would be really good and that would do the job properly. And we found two wonderful ladies, and they were with us, I think, for 4 or 5 years it ended up being. They became members of the family. You know, we cooked together. We did all kinds of stuff together. And it was really good. But that took a long time. And, you know, some people have said, you know, that there's a special place for you in heaven and this and that, and it's that ain't it, folks. I also had a come to Jesus meeting with my dad, and told him, I don't know why we're doing this. You think we owe you? It ain't because we owe you, trust me. It's just because this is who we are. This is what we do. And you better start treating my wife right. We had one friend who came to us, and she was well, more than once she came to us and said, oh, you know, I still feel so bad because you guys are taking care of three parents and I can't take care of my husband. There's no comparison. Every situation is unique. If you're caregiving, if you're thinking about caregiving, I'm going to spend the next few minutes trying to talk you out of it. It is the toughest thing you will ever do, and believe me, it's fraught with spiritual peril. You're going to be coming to confession all the time, not once a month. It's very, very hard to do. We had just the confluence of events. Our advanced preparation was one thing, but it's like having kids. You think you're ready, right? But you have no idea what you're getting into until it happens, and that's the way it is. That's the way it was for us. You know, if you're caring for someone who has a disease like cancer or any other disease, you know, the doctors will give you a diagnosis and they may give you a time of maybe 4 to 6 months to live, so, whatever it is. It's not that way with dementia. It's just not that way with Alzheimer's. Dementia is a general term for memory loss and other intellectual abilities serious enough to interfere with daily life. If you're caring for a person with Alzheimer's, they get worse by the inch, not by the day. It's a long, long road. It's been called the long goodbye, and it is. But it also makes it very hard to know what stage they're in and when to do certain things. Like, when do you take the checkbook away? When do you take the car away? And when is it no longer safe for them to live by themselves? When her mom got sick, she stayed at home, as I said, and hospice was there. And Frank did the best he could to take care of her. But fortunately, we lived just a few miles down the road. And my wife was there every day after work, after working a long shift as a restaurant manager, she would go over and check on them. And then after her mom died, she would go over and find that Frank had called and turned off the electricity. Didn't need it anymore. Yeah. Had shut off the water, you know, things like that. And another time he was there in his underwear and the thermostat was set on, I think, 85 or something. It was all kinds of things. And we knew that couldn't go on for very long. You may be a caregiver and not even know it. Do you get up at night to help your husband or a family member go to the bathroom? Do you arrange your schedule to fit your mother's doctor's appointments? Well, you're not alone. The National Alliance of Caregiving says that about 44.4 million adults provide care for their loved ones. It's estimated that 80% of all care received by older Americans is provided by family members, spouses, children, grandchildren, and other relatives just like you. Now, I mentioned earlier to someone that the worst thing that can come out of this workshop for me is that anyone would be hurt by anything that I say, whether it's in caregiving or funeral care. You know, we've all done the best that we could do with the knowledge that we had at the time. We've all buried family members who were embalmed. We've known people who were cremated. And don't, please, if anything I say is hurtful, please come to me and tell me and we can discuss it, because nothing here should be hurtful to anyone. And that includes the part about caregiving. All we're talking about is in general. These are all general things. There's nothing personal. There's nothing targeted or anything like that. It's a big decision to take care of a loved one, especially in your home. Many of us feel that it's a duty that's handed down by way of relationship, or that your obligation, it's your obligation, and that's entirely untrue. You know, even when we make marriage vows, it doesn't say you have to be a caregiver. It says you have to love, honor, and cherish. It doesn't say anything about ruining your health to take care of your loved one. The OCA website says that that intense, heavy-duty caregivers, especially spousal caregivers, do not get consistent help from other family members. One study shown that many as 3/4 are going it alone. And sadly, 61% of intense caregivers have experienced depression. 1/3 of all caregivers describe their own health as fair to poor, often indicating that they're not sure they will outlive their loved one. In those cases, there are two persons at risk. Special vigilance is needed for those in remote and rural areas, one example being Alaska. In Alaska, there's a saying, "Who will cross the river with me?" And that's a question that's applicable to many families and all caregivers, no matter where they may live. Who will cross the river with me? After all we've been through, you may find it a little strange that we've left strict instructions with our kids that they are not to do what we did. Put us in a facility. And they get all indignant and all this. The worst thing that could happen for me is that they do what we did because it's what we did. It's not something that you do for any... There are many, many, many wrong reasons to be a caregiver. Many wrong reasons. You're the eldest. You're the one who has no children, or your children are grown and gone. There are many reasons to get sucked into a very, very difficult situation. Of course, our daughters-in-law said, "No way." And I hope they really want to, but we've given them those instructions, and that's fine. In fact, I told my son, I said, "Son," he got all indignant with me, I said, "If I get to the point where I don't know who you are, what am I going to care? Put me in a facility. Live your life." If you're making a decision, or if you're in the midst of making that decision, or at some future point you find yourself making that decision, there's some things you have to think about. What is your primary motivation for accepting the role of caregiver? Is it a family obligation? Is it guilt? Is it love? Pressure? Sometimes pressure is placed on the oldest sibling or the one with no kids. If you need help, is there help available close by? Will you ask for it? Do you know your limits? Is there money available for outside help to be called in if necessary? Are you able to set boundaries? Do you have family to care for? And how would they handle another person in the home? Do you have young kids? How does your spouse feel about it? Are there teenagers in the home? Is your home appropriate for an aging parent or relative? If the home is appropriate, can remodeling be done to make it so? Is there any unresolved anger towards the person for whom you will care? Have you ever been sexually or physically abused by the care recipient? Are you physically healthy and strong enough? Oftentimes, this ends up including some heavy lifting. We're also fortunate that our sons live in the Charleston area, and one of my sons lives just about 5 blocks away. When Frank fell and broke his hip, I couldn't get him up. He was 6-something. And so I had him lay on the floor, and my 6-foot son came over, and we were able to get him up, and it wasn't really until then that we found out that he had a broken hip and got him to the hospital. Are there any special skills needed for caring for the patient? And if so, are these things that you can learn? How's your gag reflex? We all have one. I can deal with most anything, but I found my gag reflex. It's a reflex. There's nothing you can do about it. It's a reflex. Mine is bed sores. And you'll probably find yours. You may have to deal with insulin bed sores, feeding tubes? Can you do those things? Are you prepared for that? Can they contribute financially? Can you and or your siblings contribute to their care, or will they? Are there enough support systems in your community to aid in your caregiving? And don't count on the church. Everyone has their own life, they have their own problems, and they get very busy. It would be nice to think so, but don't count on it. It'll be a bonus if it happens. Learn as much as you can. Understanding what to expect will help you plan and care for the transitions. Don't take on the journey alone. We had each other. We had at least that. We did have the support that we got from the church, our church family, was they kept an eye on us. They didn't come to visit, they didn't come to help, but they kept an eye on us. And they were always checking to see that we were okay. No one can be awake 24 hours a day. You have your own health and your own obligations to consider. Having support for a caregiver is key, whether it's from other family, in-home help, respite care, or making the decision to move your loved one into an assisted living or nursing home. You know, I flew up here, and I guess most of us have been on a commercial flight at some time or another, and they tell you about if the cabin loses oxygen pressure, the mask is going to fall down. Put your mask on first. You're of no use to the other people if you can't breathe. You are of no use to your loved one if you're sick and falling apart. Take care of yourself first. A little bit further back here, I'll get into some other things. And preparing the home, there's a lot of things in here about preparing the home, but it's basically childproof the house. It's the same thing. Look around the house. Think about what's dangerous in this house. You know, take up the rugs. If you have hardwood floors with rugs on them like we do, get rid of them. They went into storage for 6 years. All those nice rugs that she bought, they were in storage for 6 years. Because they'll slip. Bathrooms, we had, I tore out a closet in a small bathroom, made it a big bathroom, not huge, but big enough, with a 36-inch door that we could take a wheelchair and take them in and shower them in the wheelchair. We bought a PVC wheelchair that made that possible. And that was a big help. The whole room was a shower pan, so that when we were finished, we could just hose down the whole room, scrub it down with a deck brush, and all was well. Any questions so far while I'm trying to read my wife's notes? Yes, ma'am.
How long did you have to take care of your parents?
How long? All together, it was about 6 years. 6 years. My dad was there for three. Frank was with us, I think, for five, and then my mother died a year after that. She was the last to go. Yes, sir.
Nursing home stays are on the average 3 years, so you increase their life, I understand.
Yeah, and that's an open question. You know, you deal with that. Was that a good thing? My mother was bedridden the whole time. And Frank was bedridden the last year. So they got, I can assure you, they got better health care than they got in a nursing home. Because, and that's beyond doubt, every time they went into a nursing home when they broke their hip, or mom had a very serious urinary tract infection, they came home with bed sores and had lost weight. In the 5 years mother was in bed, in her own bed in our home, she never had a bed sore. Frank came home with a bed sore on his heel that you could see the bone. And I don't want to freak anybody out or scare anyone about it. When the time comes to put your parents in a nursing home or whoever it may be, it's something that has to be done. You do the best you can do. You do your homework, you do your research, and you try to do the best for them. But even in the hospital, when my dad was in the hospital, we were told, oh, we don't do nursing anymore. If you want your parent, your dad, to get full-time care, someone to help him go to the bathroom, someone to help him get meals, someone to get him keep him hydrated, you either have to pay someone or be here yourself. So we were there ourselves. So if they don't do that in the hospital for short term, what's going on in the nursing home in the long term? And that's exactly the point, is it's not happening. When a parent goes into a nursing home, and let's be generous and say that the attendant only has six patients, how do they get fed? My mother couldn't feed herself. It took an hour and a half to 2 hours for her to eat dinner. And we sat there and just, you know, fed her. They're not going to do that in a nursing home. They can't. It's not possible. She's got six patients. She brings in the food. She cleans up after them, and that's it. And if they don't eat, they don't eat. Who's making sure that they're hydrated? No one. So you have to make special consideration for that and either be there or have someone there. And we learned that pretty quickly. You need to do your homework. You need to get referrals. You know, when you're going through something like this, your friends know it, and they have either been through it themselves or they know someone who's been through it, and they probably have some recommendations to make. You can check the Medicare Nursing Home Finder. You don't expect everything to be perfect, but you want to know that the facility that you're looking at is in the top tier of facilities that you can afford, obviously. Take the tour. Make arrangements. Meet the administrator and have the administrator take you on the tour of this facility. Ask questions. Observe the staff and the residents and the activities that are going on there. My wife's favorite is conduct the parking lot test. Go stand in the parking lot, and when people come out, ask them what they think of the place. Go at shift change. When the employees are coming out, ask them, would you put your parent in here? Thousands of America's elderly mothers and fathers and grandparents are being killed each year in the nation's nursing homes, victims of premature and preventable deaths. They're not deaths at the hands of crazed angels of death. According to investigators and leading researchers in elder care, most are caused by fatal neglect traced to caregivers who the residents depend on for food and liquid and for turning them in their beds to prevent the formation of life-threatening bed sores. It's impossible for one nurse's aide to feed several patients in the time allotted. A study published by the Journal of Healthcare Law and Policy said, unlawful abuse and neglect is widespread, underreported, infrequently prosecuted, and the cause of untold suffering, injury, illness, and death. So once you make the decision that they're admitted, you must stay vigilant. You have to visit at different times during the day, especially at meal times. Someone has to be there to help them eat and make sure that they're being hydrated. The first time that first time my mom was in rehab after becoming weak from a severe urinary tract infection, the workers stole her nice clothing. Yeah. And she had bruises all over. And this is one of the nursing homes recommended by a social worker. So you can't always go by recommendations. You have to stay vigilant and do your own work. When she broke her hip, we made sure she was in a better facility. But we realized she was not getting fed on a regular basis. even at a top-rated facility. She couldn't feed herself. And as I said, if she can't feed herself, they can't do it for her. Both my mom and Frank were in rehab with broken hips. Frank got bed sores. I told you about the one on his heel. That was amazing. My wife is really a very good healer. Know the nursing home staff, the members, on a first-name basis and become comfortable interacting with them. Work with them through care plan meetings and other visits. They have to know that you're active and that you're there and you're watching. And let go of the guilt. Even if you planned the move with your loved one, there's always guilt and self-doubt. Am I doing the right thing? You know, Mark and Elizabeth took care of three, and I can't take care of one, and why can't I do better? As I said, every situation is unique. You can't base what you have to do on what someone else did. You can only... Emotion always gets into it, but you have to try to be rational and make the right decision and let the guilt go. You can't feel guilty. You do the best you can do, and we let God take care of the rest. Elder care attorneys can help you get your loved one's affairs in order. They work with Medicaid, veterans benefits, the advanced directives that we're going to talk about here in a minute. There is something called VA, Aid in Attendance, for World War II veterans. Frank and my father both had this. It's a wonderful program, and it really helps pay some of the expenses for World War II vets. It'll also pay for a nursing home. I shouldn't say pay for. It will contribute to a nursing home. There's a Medicaid waiver program that helps individuals live at home rather than in a facility. It's only for low income, varies from state to state. And at the time she wrote this, South Carolina had a waiting list. Medicare will not pay for a nursing home unless the person is in there for rehab, extending nursing care after hospitalization. Medicaid will pay for nursing homes, and not all nursing homes accept Medicaid patients, however. And, of course, as we all know, all of this stuff is a political football, and things change all the time. So it helps to have someone like an elder care attorney who is up on the latest changes to Medicaid, Medicare. Home health can provide help with bathing, rehab, occupational therapy. Alzheimer, respite grants are a godsend. If you are caring for a loved one with Alzheimer's, the Alzheimer's Association is wonderful. They actually, if you can get in line at the right time, they actually gave us $500 to get help, to have someone stay with the parents so we could go away. That respite care is the most important thing that you can do. You know, we're pretty rational, intelligent people, and going into it, we knew that we would need some time away. And we initially said, okay, we're going to take 1 weekend a month, and we're just, you know, we'll go downtown. We'll do something. It really ended up being 1 weekend every quarter or thereabouts. We would get away a weekend, maybe 4 times a year we could get away for a weekend, and of course we had to pay someone to stay with the parents, and that's all well and good. But if you've got one weekend out of 12, and Charleston is a tourist destination, and we said, okay, my wife's a great tour guide. She finds all kinds of deals on hotels and great stuff, and we would go downtown. Okay, we're going to go to the Mills House. We're going to spend the weekend, and we're going to go to all the galleries, and we'll go out to eat, and we'll go here, and we'll go there. We'll do all these things we've been wanting to do, and we slept for 3 days. We would check in, have dinner in the restaurant at the Mills house, go to bed, get up in the morning, go have breakfast, go back to bed, have some lunch, go back to bed. Seriously, we didn't leave. In fact, we were working on the first edition of the book, and we rented a beach house out on Folly Beach to spend the weekend and work on editing the book. And we walked on the beach twice, I think, for a total of maybe an hour in the whole weekend. And we spent a lot of time sleeping. You will spend time catching up on sleep. But respite care is everything. Getting away is the most important thing that you can do.
One of our friends here in St. Philip, she's a nurse by trade, that's her profession, but she works as a home health aide. So that I guess they have to get approved by Medicare or whatever. But she goes into the home of her client and helps them bathe or cook something, or sometimes she takes them shopping and stuff. Is that something that they're trying to do more of so that people don't have to go into the nursing home? And did your relatives have that?
They did not. They did not have that. They did not have someone to take them out and do things with them. Those programs are available, but you have to look for them. You know, they're not going to come to you. And my wife kind of became a clearinghouse for elder care and all kinds of, because she was looking. You have to look for them and find out what's available. And there is more and more. With the baby boomers getting older, there's going to be more and more of that. When Ella, my mother-in-law, died, she was under hospice care, and it was primarily voluntary hospice. 10 years later, it was all for-profit hospice. So it's a different scene. But still, can't say enough good stuff about hospice. If you don't know what hospice is, it's a program that tries to provide death with dignity and comfort, I guess is one way to put it. Today hospice care provides humane and compassionate care for people in the last phases of incurable disease so that they may live as fully and comfortably as possible. It's a philosophy of care. It accepts death as the final stage of life. The goal is to help patients live their last days as alert and pain-free as possible. That's what we all want, right? We want to stay alert. I want to be able to pray and be pain-free as possible. Hospice tries to manage the symptoms of a person's last days. Hospice affirms life, neither hastens nor postpones death. Hospice care treats the person rather than the disease. It focuses on the quality rather than the length of life. Hospice care is family-centered. It includes the patient and the family in making decisions. Many people don't think about hospice until the very end, which is a big mistake. If you find yourself in this type of situation, or you have a friend who may be in this situation, start thinking about hospice. You can't think about it too early. When many people think that putting a loved one into hospice care is a death sentence. It definitely is not. My mother cycled in and out of hospice care 3 times. Frank went in and out of hospice care 2x. What happens when the doctor certifies that someone is eligible for hospice care, and that generally means that death may occur within the next 6 months. What happens when that trigger is pulled and they go into hospice care, they get all kinds of additional benefits. They get all kinds of additional help. And very often, patients recover and live longer. As I say, my mother went in and out of hospice care 3 times. Some of the services that become available when someone qualifies for hospice care are nursing care, social services, a social worker can come to the house, physician services. We were very fortunate. We found a doc on call. He was a great doctor, and all he did, his whole practice was home visits. He didn't have an office. He didn't work in a hospital. He took care of people who were in their homes. Just an absolute, you know, providential event. I don't know how many of those there are in the whole world, but he happened to live in our neighborhood, so it was great. Spiritual support and counseling. When you walk into our house, it kind of looks like this. There's icons everywhere. We've been collecting icons for 40 years, so she won't allow me to buy another icon. But they look around and go, oh. So the chaplain came and looked around and said, well, what can I do for you? I said, well, please, sit with them and read the Bible. And she did, and it was great. Home health aids. You can't afford them, but hospice care can. Trained volunteer support. That's not quite as prevalent these days because most hospice these days are for profit, as I said. Physical, occupational, and speech therapies. Respite care, the most important part. Inpatient care. Bereavement support. Hopefully we have all the bereavement support we're ever going to need right here in this place. It's very hard for physicians to determine how long anyone with a terminal disease has to live. This is especially hard for patients with advanced dementia. As I said, my mother couldn't speak for 5 years. She could say yeah, and she could say no, but because that was the only thing she could say, we didn't know if she was responding appropriately. So it's obviously she couldn't tell us she was in pain unless we saw her wince when we moved her and things like that. So it's much harder to know what's going on with an Alzheimer's patient than it is with anyone else. Medicare regulations require a physician to certify that a patient entering hospice is likely to die of their disease within 6 months. It's really hard to assess that with an Alzheimer's patient. There isn't a single specific point in an illness when end-of-life care begins. It very much depends on the individual. For other life-limiting illnesses other than Alzheimer's, the following are signs that you may want to talk with your loved one about palliative care. Now, palliative care is care that is just to make a patient comfortable. It's primarily pain management and pain care. If the patient has made multiple trips to the emergency room, they've been admitted to the hospital several times within the last year with the same or worsening symptoms, they wish to remain at home rather than spend time in the hospital, and they've decided to stop receiving treatments for their disease. Not everyone who's dying experiences pain, but there are things that you can do to help someone who does. And that's what palliative care is concentrated on. My wife is very close to the nuns at St. Mary and Martha Monastery in Wagoner, South Carolina. She was especially close to Mother Lubov, and Mother Lubov had cancer and she was dying. And even as close as my wife is to the nuns up there, they more or less just shut down. They were going to care for her, take care of her all themselves. Elizabeth finally, to show you how difficult this kind of thing is, that one nun was sick with cancer and dying, two nuns were taking care of her, and they couldn't manage. They were hurting themselves. So finally, my wife called, and Mother Thecla said, yes, please come. She was fortunate to be there on her last day, her last night, actually. And Mother Lubov was in terrible pain. And Elizabeth asked Mother Thecla, why? Why is she in such pain? Well, she wants to be conscious. She wants to be able to pray. Mother, she's in too much pain to pray. You give me the medication. They had cut her dose in half, what was prescribed, because they were afraid it would hurt her or put her to sleep. But if you know anything about intense pain, and I know several people with intense pain, it takes enormous dosage of pain killers just to take the edge off with that much pain. So they gave her the right amount of medication. She calmed down. Mother Lubov was a former Catholic, and my wife is a former Catholic. So Mother Lubov calmed down, and they prayed the rosary the rest of the night. Pain management is important. Pain is not good. We all want to be as alert and pain-free as we can toward the end so that we can pray. St. Basil the Great noted that with mandrake, doctors give us sleep, and with opium, they lull violent pain. We all pray for a Christian ending to our life painless, blameless, and peaceful, and a good defense before the dread judgment seat of Christ. Struggling with severe pain can be draining. It can make it hard for families to be together in a meaningful way. Pain can affect the mood, and being in pain can make someone angry and short-tempered. Although understandable, irritability resulting from pain might make it hard to talk, hard to share thoughts and feelings. We have to make people comfortable toward the end. I know we're getting short on time, so let me move on to some practical matters and some legal matters. For if you are considering starting a ministry like this in your church, I don't know how many churches might be here. I know that this church is certainly heading in that direction. We recommend that a parish visitation ministry can be a really helpful first step. You've probably found, you know, there are some people who, this is just their ministry. This is the way they are. If somebody's in the hospital, they go visit them. If somebody's sick at home, they'll go visit them. They'll call them. They'll do that ain't me. But some people do. Others of us, like me, need someone to say, hey, would you go do this? You know, a ministry, an organized ministry that someone can keep track of everyone, especially in a larger or a growing parish, the priest can't keep track of everyone. You know, the scientists have told us that the human brain is constructed to manage about 100 relationships. Anything beyond that, we just can't keep track of them. So a visitation ministry is important. Who's in the hospital? Who's sick at home? And what is their condition? And just to be there for support. Now, if you've seen the first edition of our book, A Christian Ending, in the back, we put some forms in there. This is another one of those things I just sat down and said, okay, what do we need? Well, we need some legal forms. The first one that you need is a healthcare power of attorney. Anyone who is going into the hospital really needs to have this form. This is a power of attorney for your health care. It assigns someone who knows you, who cares for you, the responsibility of making decisions for you if you're not able to. You have to have this form. Otherwise, no one can make those decisions for you. And the law says no one has the ability, so the doctors, what they're going to do is keep you alive no matter what. It's their job. That's the way it works. So you definitely need to have one of these. After the first edition of the book here a couple of years ago, the OCA, we have any healthcare workers in here, you may have seen a form that the Roman Catholic Church put out called Five Wishes. Has anyone ever seen that form? It was meant to be a non-threatening way to go through and tell people how you want things to be at the end of life, and it was promoted to us in that sort of way. So I took a copy of it and I sent it to my attorney, and he asked me where I got it. I told him, he said, this form is legally worthless. There is nothing in here to make it. It was a form where you said, if I'm incapacitated, I wish for this, I wish for this, I wish for this, I wish for this, because it was called Five Wishes. Wishes are not legally enforceable. It's the matter of a word, a single word. The proper word is, I direct this, I direct that. You will do this, you will do that. Not, this is, oh, I kind of like for it to be this way. That's what wish means. I'd kind of like for you to. No, you have to direct that this is what I want to have done. So the OCA put together a committee to come up with a set of hopefully non-threatening end-of-life forms that would actually have some force of law behind them that could actually be enforceable in court if need be. They also decided that the Roman Catholic version wasn't really orthodox, some of the things that it said, and we needed to correct that. So my spiritual father was a member of the committee, so guess who got to write the forms? So you'll find two sets of forms on the OCA website, and you can just, when you get there, or you can just search them on Google, you can search for a gift for my loved ones. And this really is a gift for your loved ones. This prevents them from having to make all the terrible decisions that you would make for yourself, but they don't really want to have to deal with this. The first one is a healthcare power of attorney. Here you assign someone who you've spoken with and they've agreed, and you've given them the authority to make healthcare decisions on your behalf if you cannot. And there's also an alternate. You know, if you choose someone, they're out of the country, or maybe they've predeceased you, then you have an alternate in here. These forms were vetted by Orthodox bioethicists, Orthodox priests. They were approved by the OCA Synod, and numerous attorneys have looked at them. We tried to make them effective in all 50 states. And it turns out what makes a form effective in different jurisdictions is simply something called the formality of signature. Some states require a signature. Some states require a signature with a witness. Some states require a signature with a witness in a notary public. So we just went with the most formal form of signature, formality of signature, and they should be good in all 50 states. The next form that you need is a declaration of a desire for a natural death. This is also known as a living will. With this document, you're telling this person who you've given your power of attorney, you're telling them what it is you want to be done. If your physician and one other physician who has personally examined me certify in writing that I am permanently unconscious with a ventilator breathing for me, permanently unconscious with a feeding tube and or intravenous hydration, maintained on a ventilator when there is little or no chance for recovery, or in any other permanent or terminal medical condition due to which the application of life-sustaining treatment would serve only to artificially prolong the process of dying or maintain me in a permanent medical condition, then I direct that you will do this. And you can go through here, and it helps you make certain decisions on how you want things to be done from that point on. The second group of forms here is Another Gift for My Loved Ones. Very creative titles we put on these. This is simply the first form is a refined version of the one that's in the first edition of the book. You'll also find these in the back of the second edition. We use these very forms in the back. You can see them and you can read them before you download them. But we created in the first version an advanced directive for funeral care. In essence, a death care power of attorney. Same thing as any other power of attorney. I'm going to designate Xenia to make decisions for me at the time of my death. And an alternate if she's not available. And then, I don't know if you'd call it non-threatening or not, but we tried to make it just check the box. And we've tried to think of everything that's involved in a funeral, such as there's a checkbox. I prefer a home and church funeral with minimum or no mortuary involvement, or I prefer a mortuary, and fill in the name. I direct that the person or organizations named below perform and or coordinate the following services. Notify relatives, church, executor, or other. Prepare the body for burial, church, mortuary, or family. Provide a casket, church, mortuary, or family. Check the box and go right on down through here. How do you want these things to be done? We also have a page here for people to be notified of my death. You can fill that out. The obituary information, we've tried to make that as easy as possible, things that people don't think of. Important documents and locations. And one that is new to this form that I hadn't thought of before is your digital estate. I have learned that, all of us, most of us, never say all, probably most of us have all kinds of digital residue out there. You know, you've got a Google account, you have a Yahoo account, you have an Amazon account, you have a Netflix account, you've got all these things out there. You have an ID and you have a password. Well, it turns out that those, whoever these digital imps are out there, are taking that information from deceased people and using it on the internet. So it becomes important to dispose of your digital estate. And then a page for additional information and comments that you can give to people. Also recommend, now, fill these out, keep the original in a safe place, give copies to family, best friend, definitely to the people named in here as your with power of attorney. And I also recommend that they be kept at the church. There should be a copy, I think, on file at the church. That's just my opinion. You can debate that. You can talk about it yourselves. I just think it's good to have one place where everything is kept so everybody knows where it is. The worst thing that can happen is somebody dies and nobody can find anything. What good does it do to fill it out if you can't find it? Right? If you didn't know, don't keep important papers like this in a safe deposit box in a bank. Because at the moment of death, the safe deposit box is sealed. You can't get to them because it belongs to the dead person. And it won't be opened until probate or after probate. We try not to deal with probate at all. How are we doing, Father?
As long as you want.
Any questions? No, it doesn't have to be an attorney. The power of attorney is good when it's signed and signed by a notary public.
So that's all it takes?
Yes. Yeah. The notary public is an official witness of the state. They're licensed by the state to be a witness. That's something that a lot of people don't understand. I'm a notary public, and people come to me and say, would you notarize this for me? And then they start telling me all about it. I mean, that's fine. You can tell me what it is, but you don't have to because I don't care. In essence, that's not what a notary public is. The only thing a notary public is doing is saying that, yes, the person who signed this is the person they say they are. And when you come to me, if I don't know you personally, I need to see your ID because you could be signing someone else's name. And I'm testifying that the person whose signature, that the signature that's on here is the signature of the person who's supposed to be on here. That's all I'm doing. I'm witnessing a signature. I don't need to know, you know, all about the mortgage and how that's all changed and all this, you know, everything else you want to tell me. I don't need to know that. I'm just witnessing that you are who you say you are. That's it. Yes?
I also learned that power of attorney is only good for about 10 years. So I was told it was good forever because a lot of places don't want to accept it if it's more than 10 years old.
Power of attorney is only good for 10 years. I had not heard that. I'll ask my attorney about that. I will ask my attorney about that because I'll have to redo mine. Now, there is, you should also know about a durable power of attorney. This is something that I don't throw out there lightly, and please hear me and hear me very well. A durable power of attorney is a time bomb waiting to go off. When you have you assign a durable power of attorney, it gives the person you assign complete authority over everything, independent of your mental state and your ability to make your own decisions. Independent of that, it has to be a person of absolute trust. The only one I have is my wife. And we have durable power of attorney for each other. I need to check into that because it was executed years ago. The reason for having that is if I'm in an accident or something, she needs to take care of the bank, she needs to take care of Vanguard, she needs the T. Rowe Price, she needs all of these things, she needs to be able to take care of things. And that's what a durable power of attorney gives a person access to everything to do with your life, not just healthcare decisions, but everything, all of your money and everything. So whoever you give durable power of attorney to has to be absolutely trustworthy. Literally trust them with your life. However, that being said, it's absolutely essential that when you go into caregiving, you get durable power of attorney for that parent or loved one that you're caregiving for. That's absolutely first step one. Get that. You're going to need it eventually. You may not need it, just like, you know, my father was very controlling, very private. He kept everything close to the vest, and he didn't want anybody to know what his financial situation was. But ultimately, we had to take over. We needed it.
So, how did you get it if he's incapacitated?
He understood. He understood that. Well, he trusted me. That's a great luxury in life, isn't it? You know, our sons, we feel just so blessed that we have two sons that we can trust. Another thing, I'm sorry, go ahead with your question.
I was going to say that the Pennsylvania attorney that checked into this for me told me that big banks, for example, like American Bank and Fargo,
yeah,
they create their own rules. They have their own legal departments, and they create all sorts of rules for people with power of attorney.
Well,
if it's over 10 years.
Sure, they've got their money. They should not be allowed to make their own rules in that regard. But they've got their money, and the longer they can keep it, the better for them. I can understand why they would want to do that, but they should not be allowed to make rules like that, that they won't accept a legitimate power of attorney. I was going to say, in financial matters, my dad taught me very early on, it's very important for all of us, I don't care how old you are or what, have two people on every account, okay? And it's not just me and my wife either. We love to travel. We love to travel abroad. If anything should happen to us, okay. Yeah. So several years back, and I can't remember exactly why, but Vanguard told us that for some reason I could no longer be a joint owner on my wife's account, and she could no longer be a joint owner on my account. I can't remember why. But it was easy enough to solve. You know, we split everything equally and put one son on her account and one son on my account, because they're going to inherit it anyway. But this way they avoid probate. Have two people on every checking account, two people on every savings account. They are both joint owners on every stock account, Vanguard, T. Rowe Price, whatever you have two people.
Is that an and or an or?
It would be an or. If you have and, both people have to sign. It would be or, okay? It can't be Mark and Elizabeth, because if it's Mark and Elizabeth, both Mark and Elizabeth have to sign on anything for anything to get done. That's exactly right. But if you die, the other person is a joint owner, they automatically take control of those funds. That's why we split it half and half, one son, one son. This is bad. This is being recorded, isn't it? They don't even know this. It's going to be a nice surprise. They're totally trustworthy. We trust them with our life, but they don't know this. They know they're on certain accounts, but they don't know this one. So it's very important. When my dad died, he had forgotten a few things, and they had to be probated. Now, what's probate? Probate, everything's on hold. If the person died and that bank account was only owned by them, nothing can happen to that bank account until it goes through probate. Well, what is probate? Probate, they publish the fact that Paul Barna has died. Anyone out there who feels that Paul Barna owes them money, come to the court and tell us. And they have a certain amount of time to do that. And not until that time has elapsed are you actually able to access the money. So how long can that be? Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what it would be in Pennsylvania. It can be months, I can tell you that. In some cases, it can be years. So if you need access to the money, make sure that your family has access to the money, and you do that by putting more than one person on the account. Okay. Thank you all very much. Hallelujah, hallelujah.